All right, well, good morning. Welcome to our more intimate Pentateuch class this week. Thank you for finding your way around campus. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Father God, we're mindful of Moses' warnings, particularly that we covered last week, that we not forget, that we remember the Lord who is the source of all of our blessing, the Lord who is our righteousness, and particularly that we examine our lives. We heard about every aspect of worship last week and the statutes and commandments that you charged Israel with to honor you, to serve and love you alone among all of the gods, to preserve themselves and to purge the evil from among them. We pray that we would follow the spirit of these laws as we come to worship you this week, that we would remember and not forget, be mindful, and moreover, that we would be sure to understand the lesson Moses is teaching us here in the book of Deuteronomy. We thank you for this word and pray that you would give us diligence in learning it. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, well, welcome back to the whirlwind. If you were with us last week, we covered seven chapters, and the topic was very, very cyclical, or I described it something as a whirlwind. You can imagine all these topics of laws and commandments swirling around you in a whirlwind, and Moses reaches in and grabs one. Sometimes he gets back to that same topic and talks about it again a few chapters later. Other times it's a one-off. We've never heard of it before. We'll never hear of it again. Well, there's a method to the madness of all of this. Moses is, on the one hand, he's emphasizing the variety and diversity of the statutes and rules that Israel was to obey, the extent that they had in everyday life, that there was no part of life that was not meant to be governed. And we're going to talk more about that this week. On the other hand, we cannot forget the context of how we got here. There are two key verses that explain where we're at in the Pentateuch. Perhaps three. We can start with chapter 1, verse 5. Moses sought to explain the law to the people. That's the whole purpose of the book of Deuteronomy. This is the explanation of what's come so far. Chapter 6, verse 1, the beginning of this sermon. Recall that chapter 5, the Ten Commandments, was the sermon text. Chapter 6 begins the sermon and the first words of the sermon. Now, this is the commandment, singular, the statutes and the rules, plural. Moses' emphasis throughout that was there are Ten Commandments, there are 613 laws, but there's really just one commandment you need to know, the Shema. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your mind. And all of the points of that sermon had been around here is how to keep the one commandment. Don't fear the other gods and the other nations, chapter 7. Don't fear yourself and take credit for the great works that God has done among you, chapter 8. Chapter 9 and 10, don't even think that it's because of your righteousness that the Lord has chosen you and brought you in. You're not a righteous nation. It is because the Lord has set his favor on you and because of the unrighteousness of the nations in Canaan that the Lord is bringing you into this land. It's his doing, not yours. Chapter 11, he comes to his conclusion of the sermon. It sort of feels like a very Presbyterian sermon. You read the text, your introductory statement, principle, three points on the principle, and then a concluding chapter in chapter 11, which is tying back to chapter 6. Like many good sermons come full circle and reference the introduction and the conclusion. He says, you shall be careful to do everything that the Lord has commanded you. And once again, you shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them as you walk in the way. The point all throughout is if you get one thing from this book, Israel, if there's only one thing you understand, that's fine because there's only one thing you need to understand. Love the Lord your God. And all of the stories that have come so far, all of Genesis through Numbers, have been backing that story up, backing that one commandment up. How was it that Abraham kept the law before it was given? How was it that he seems to be the one righteous human character that we have? Everyone else is so much of a mixed bag, and it's somewhat true of Abraham as well. And yet he stands out as the example of a law keeper when there was no law. Well, it was because he loved the Lord. It was because he feared the Lord. He knew the one commandment. And so the statutes and the rules, those could all fall into place for him if he knew and kept that one great commandment. But chapter 12 is our next guidepost. verse 1, which we read last week, these are the statutes and the rules that you shall be careful to do in the land. So now he's saying, yes, there is just one commandment, but that doesn't mean you get to ignore the statutes and the rules. I'm not telling you, forget everything else, erase the parts of the Pentateuch that weren't directly about this. This is all there actually was for you to get. If you love the Lord your God, these are the things that you will do in the land. This is what a life that loves the Lord your God looks like. And so for 15 chapters, from 12 to 26, Moses holds us up to the whirlwind. This flurry of topics that are cyclical and coming lightning fast. Sometimes we get a whole chapter where we can call out a theme. We're going to see that this week. Other times you get a solitary verse, one sentence, and then we move on to the next topic. He's emphasizing the variety and the extent, but all of it, we're meant to remember, is pointing us back, no matter what the scenario you find yourself in life, no matter how complicated or nuanced, maybe it's one of the topics that's not directly addressed in the Pentateuch. If you love the Lord your God, he cares about how it's dealt with. He's not ambivalent towards our lives. There's a way to work out the love of the Lord in every aspect of life, in every circumstance we find ourselves in. That love for the Lord is to be our guide. And so these are very much exemplary laws, meant to emphasize variety. Many times we're not given even enough information to keep the law that he's prescribing. We're going to hear this morning a law for beatings. We are given maybe one instance of beatings being prescribed in the Pentateuch as a punishment for crime. Presumably there were others. Presumably he didn't have a one sentence on a crime that deserves a beating and eight sentences on how that beating is to be judged, how large it should be, how it's to be carried out, etc. So Moses is not preserving for the writer everything we need to do the statutes and the rules. Rather, he's preserved everything we need to keep the one great commandment. And he's giving us examples of the statutes and the rules. And I think we've said that that's been his purpose all along in the book of the law. We don't have a comprehensive set of rules that Israel was to follow. Some of the laws are very much given in a way that we can't quite reconstruct. And even a reader of it many hundreds of years ago in Hebrew, original Hebrew, would not have been able to necessarily reconstruct from the text precisely what Israel was meant to do, because Moses' point is not, reader, you should do this. Moses' point is, you need to do the one thing. For Israel, here's what that looked like. There was not any part of life that escaped from it. What will it look like for you in the 21st century in the church? That's Moses can't really touch on that per se, except to say that if you keep that one great commandment, if you remember it, if you treasure it, if you write it on your doorposts, you'll figure out the statutes and the rules. You'll be able to get there. So that brings us up to chapter 19. Sorry, I think that's where we begin our reading. I wrote down read verses 1 through 3, and I didn't write down the starting chapter. But yes, it is chapter 19. So that's where we're going to begin today. In chapters 12 through 18, the variety of laws that we covered have all been about worship. As he turns to the statutes and rules, many of the crimes described, he says, put this one to death or put that one to death. They're serious, high, capital crimes, and yet none of them are about how men relate to one another in the covenant community. They are all about worship. And over again, his emphasis in those chapters, I want to say 20 times, he talks about the place that the Lord will choose to put his name upon it. Do you want to know what you ought to do in the land, Israel? Go to the temple. Go 3 times a year for your feasts. Bring your tithes there. If you're so far away that your tithe will not survive, you've got a young, like a yearling lamb that by the time you get there is going to be 2 years old instead of one, that's fine. The tithe isn't what's important. Sell it. I think in that case, it wasn't about tithes. It was about the firstborn offering. Sell that. Take your money with you, but you need to go to the temple. Get to the temple. And the other interesting thing that we noted there, as they were to bring all their offerings, before we heard so much about sacrifice in Leviticus, which offerings to bring, and we got a pretty procedural description. Throughout these chapters, the description we get is you bring your offerings and you have a feast in Jerusalem. Each of these offerings, maybe not every single one of them, but certainly the first fruits offering, the free will offering, the thanksgiving offerings, they were meant to be eaten with the priests, the tithes even. It wasn't just meant to be given to the priest, like this was mine and now it's theirs and I leave it and go away, I have no interest in it anymore. You were to bring it and essentially have a party, particularly where he tells them to sell their offering for money and to bring it to Jerusalem. We noted, he tells them when he says, you get to Jerusalem and then you buy. And what should you buy? My thought is, well, you sold a yearling lamb, you should buy a yearling lamb so that it's exactly what you owe. It's not what he says. Buy whatever you crave. He uses the word crave, that same word that was such trouble for Israel in the wilderness as they craved water and craved meat. Buy whatever you crave, whatever you have an appetite for, whatever you desire, and go and throw a party. He even throws in strong drink among the things that they could buy and bring to the temple for offering. This was meant to be a good time. It was meant to be a celebration. It was meant to be a feast, these regular times of gathering with the people and the priests. They were to gather over a meal together. And that's what the sacrificial system, that's sort of the picture we get of the sacrificial system in these chapters. Now in chapter 19, we change our focus. Just like many people have observed in the Ten Commandments, you have maybe four commandments that are about how we relate to God and then six commandments about how we relate to man. We had seven chapters here in the statutes and rules that covered exclusively worship. It was the most important thing to talk about. And now we're going to have eight chapters from 19 to 26 about how we are to relate to man. So I'm going to read from chapter 19. Oh, let me cover one more thing before I get started on the verses. We had that theme, the place the Lord will set his name upon, in the previous chapters. In these chapters, that theme is mostly gone. We're not going to hear about it. What we are going to hear about instead is that we should purge, that Israel should purge the evil from among them. Over and over again, the reason for the commandments is you should purge the evil from among you. And the second reason given, or maybe you might call it the first, is that the land is the Lord's. Over and over again, he says, don't bring blood guilt upon the land. The Lord walks among you, and therefore the holiness of the land is to be preserved. When we sin, it's not even a humanitarian thing. The reason that I shouldn't sin against Aaron, in my mind, is because Aaron is a human being imbued with the image of God, equal to me, and so it's a violation of God's law to sin against him. What the Lord says is, you pollute the very inheritance I'm giving you by sinning against one another. That's the fundamental reason. There are secondary reasons, sure. The reasons that, you know, the image of God being a reason we shouldn't sin against one another is a perfectly valid reason, philosophically speaking or theologically speaking. But here in the text, it's not the focus. The focus is, you will pollute the land the Lord is bringing you into. This is his land, and that is why you should not sin against one another. So that's our theme. If you're a highlighter, go ahead and highlight as we come across these. When you hear the land is the Lord's, or the land the Lord is about to give you, or purge the evil, those are going to be your sort of themes in this section that you can catch out. And now I'll read verses 1 through 3 of chapter 19. When the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, there's our theme, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and their houses, you shall set apart three cities for yourselves in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. You shall measure the distances and divide into three parts the area of the land that the Lord your God gives you as a possession, so that any manslayer can flee to them. We've heard of the cities of refuge before, and they always seem to come up at a bit of a random time. In this case, everything feels like a bit of a random time in the whirlwind, so it's appropriate that we're back to them. Most recently, we heard about them in chapter 4, where they were told to set apart three cities east of Jordan. Now in chapter 19, they're to set apart three cities west of Jordan as they enter the land. There are to be more cities, and if their land expands even more, they are to add cities. There's always to be one close at hand for the manslayer to flee to. And there's something very critical here that I want to draw your attention to. It's down a ways. We've not read it yet, but it's in verse 9. We're looking all throughout, by the way. We're keeping our eye out for these purpose statements. And here is one where Moses seems to pause from the whirlwind. That's in the middle of a sentence. I'm sorry. So I'm going to go back to verse 8. And if the Lord your God enlarges your territory, as he has sworn to your fathers and gives you all the land that he promised to give to your fathers, provided you are careful to keep all this commandment, singular again, drawing our attention back to his central thesis, which I command you today, and what is that? By loving the Lord your God and by walking ever in his ways, then you shall add three other cities to these three. So Moses pauses from the whirlwind for a moment to remind us, don't lose sight of where we're at. We're in the whirlwind. There's all kinds of variety. We've been the largest section of Deuteronomy by far, and we're only halfway through it. But don't forget why we're here, Israel. What it's all about is about loving the Lord your God. He's telling us not to lose the thread, both to Israel, and I think in a sense he's saying that to the writer. You know, the reader. You may feel a little bit lost as we're going. Here's where we're at. Don't forget. Let's connect all the way back to that. That brings us to our next heading. By the way, your notes should look pretty overwhelming. The good news is there's only 20 really simple sections. Unfortunately, one of the 20 is just titled 21 More Laws. So buckle up. We're going to keep going. We're not going to read all of them, but I hope to touch briefly on every point. No one has reading A, chapter 19, verses 14 through 20, because I failed to pass out any readings this morning. So if someone would volunteer to take that passage, and I'll pass out the remainder while it's being read.
You shall not move your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set, and the inheritance that you will hold in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. A single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only the evidence of two witnesses, only on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses shall charge be established. If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days. The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he has had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. 19, is that right?
Through 20. Let's say 21. I don't know why I would cut off one verse.
And the rest shall hear and fear. You shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot.
Right. Thank you. So our first section, very short, just verse 14, boundary markers. Why is it that Israel shouldn't move the boundary markers in the land? It's stealing. That seems like a great reason not to do that. We can tie that back to the Ten Commandments. And yet, the reason that he gives here, he says, the inheritance that you will hold in the land that the Lord is giving you to possess. It's reminding them, you shouldn't move those boundary markers because it's not yours. It's not your neighbor's. It's the Lord's. You're not stealing from your neighbor. You're stealing from God when you do that. And so that's going to be, that's one example of the theme that we'll be revisiting again and again. And the next paragraph brings our next theme. A false witness is to be paid back with exactly the punishment they were seeking for the person they were bearing witness against. And why is that? Verse 19, they shall purge the evil from their midst. And the rest shall hear and fear and shall never again commit any such evil among you. The punishment is meant to purify God's people, and it is meant to be as an example to cause the rest of Israel to fear. Here we see the sort of the fear of the Lord. We've said that it's not a slavish fear, but we don't want to neuter that fear to the point where we say, well, it's really not fear at all. It's actually like cozy comfiness. The fear of the Lord is truly fear. It means that when we see others punished for evil, we fear lest we should also deserve such punishment, lest we should also displease the Lord in the same way. Fear among God's people is not out of character. And yet, of course, in the New Testament, we read true love casts out fear. I think what we're talking about there is not the type of fear that is the fear of the Lord or even the fear of doing evil and earning punishment, but is rather that slavish fear that draws back, that asks for a mediator at the foot of the mountain rather than going up with Moses onto the mountain. So those are our two themes already set for us side by side. I'll pause there. Any questions before we move on? All right, well, I won't pause long because the whirlwind is the whirlwind. So chapter 20 turns our attention to war. We're not going to read it. Hopefully you were able to cover it during the week in your homework reading. The beginning talks about how to plunder a city. Now, we've already been told, as you go into the land, don't plunder the cities. Everything is to be devoted to destruction. And yet, in chapter 20, we're given instructions for plunder, particularly to offer terms of peace before sieging a city. And only sieging it if they will not accept the terms of peace. And halfway through, Moses almost interrupts himself and says, now keep in mind, this is for cities far off. This is not for cities in the land. There, you're not to put your hands to anything in that city. There's a number of literary devices that cause this section to parallel Abraham's refusal of plunder after saving Lot. The priests are the ones who are to charge God's people in this passage. And of course, the priest Melchizedek shows up in the Abraham narrative. They're reminded that they're going after an army greater than them. And Genesis 14 reminds us that Abraham takes only the strong, dedicated men of his household, dedicated men of his household, 318, to go after the other king, five kings in the land? And there's that word dedicated. Abraham's army is formed of those who are dedicated men. And there's a very similar word. Both of them are only used once in the Pentateuch, but they're grammatically related. If you have not dedicated your house, you're exempted from warfare. So there's a grammatical or a linguistic connection between these. Abraham, when he's offered the plunder, he says he will accept only what his men eat. And that's another connection that'll be hard to spot in the English. But in verse 14 of chapter 20, we're told that the spoil is Israel's to, I believe the ESV has, enjoy. The literal is the spoil is theirs to eat. So Moses seems to be drawing some connections to the life of Abraham here. And we're going to see that. That's going to be another pattern throughout. We're going to have little vignettes of laws that reflect on stories that have come so far. And it'll be interesting to see how they reflect. In this case, we're reflecting on Abraham as essentially having obeyed this law as he pursued the Canaanite kings, in spite of the fact that he did not have this law as he pursued the Canaanite kings. More on that as we go. Verses 19 and 20 are interesting. I'll read them. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. This is another one of those instances where we might be tempted to say this is humanitarian, right? You don't destroy the siege nation's food source because there will be a next year. And a year after that, there will need to be a people living here, and they will need to eat food. So for humanitarian reasons, you don't destroy their food, even if you cut it off from them for a time in sieging. And yet that's not what the text gives us at all. Why is it that you don't destroy their fruit trees? Your war isn't against creation. Your war is against fallen, sinful man in the land. That's who you're to drive out, not my creation that I've put there to bless you. God's priorities in these laws are very different from the ones we might anticipate as they go forward. That brings us to chapter 21, and I do want to have a moment to read there, reading B, verses 1 through 9.
So if in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess, someone is found slain, lying in the open country, and it is not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall come out. They shall measure the distance to the surrounding cities, and the elders of the city that is nearest to the slain man shall take a heifer that has never been worked and that has not pulled a yoke. And the elders of the city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And by their word, every dispute and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of the city, of that city nearest to the slain man, shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they shall testify, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it shed. Accept atonement, O Lord, for your people, whom you have redeemed, and do not set the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel, so that their blood guilt be atoned for. So you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord.
Thank you. So this ritual is not mentioned anywhere else in the Pentateuch, which alone is worth just pausing to consider for a moment. Deuteronomy 1:5, Moses explained the law to the people of Israel. And as he's explaining, he gives us 9 verses on a red heifer ritual that's not mentioned anywhere else. Is he freestyling? Is he making it up as he goes? I think what we have here is more evidence that we do not have all of the laws that Israel was to obey. The people, as they went into the land, had some sort of book of law, some sort of book of rules that we have sections of in the Pentateuch, in the Torah, selections from, examples to show us what it's like. It's not preserved for us. Moses didn't attempt to preserve it for us because the point for us, the readers, is not to obey the statutes and the rules. Every little minutia that was given to Israel, those were for Israel. The point for us, once again, let's point back, is that one great commandment. That's what we need to know. We're given these laws as examples. So here's another, more evidence for that sort of exemplary nature of the laws that we're encountering here. Why the elaborate ritual for an unsolved murder? In our day and age, detectives will investigate likely homicides, and when there's not a clear suspect or a clear avenue of investigation, after a time it becomes a cold case, unsolved, and perhaps the Discovery Channel will pick it up in 10 or 15 years and produce a documentary about it. There's not much ritual about that. It's a sign of defeat. We couldn't figure it out. We don't know what to do. It's still open. It's called open unsolved. And yet there's no work we can meaningfully do to move it forward. In Israel, this did not alleviate guilt. Investigating a murder was not just about, we need to find the one who is guilty so that they can pay for their guilt. Rather, there is a collective guilt. There has been a murder among us. The land that the Lord has given us has been polluted by bloodshed. Something has to be done about it. And in the event that we cannot discover, which you have to imagine would be a frequent occurrence in Israel, obviously, there's no DNA, there's no fingerprinting, the investigative tools would be really, really slim. The number of scenarios where you would encounter a stranger with no witnesses likely to come around seem to be quite high. You're not done yet. It's not just about finding the individual. It's about not polluting the land. The people had a responsibility to deal with guilt even when it was hidden, which we've heard before in Leviticus, so it sort of carries forward that theme. It left blood guilt, and they were to purge that guilt from among them through this particular sacrifice. Verses 10 through 14, once again, shift gears. The treatment of captive women. They assume that they have captive women, which means that we're not talking about nations in the land of Canaan because they're not to take captives from those nations. Instead, this assumes conquests beyond Canaan or wars beyond Canaan. There are rights for the captor, including the right to marry the captive women, something that we would consider fairly detestable by our modern moral standards, seem to be given concession in the law. And yet, what the law focuses on is not on the rights of the captor, but particularly on the protection for the captives. The captor may not marry her hastily. She must have a time to grieve the fact of being a captive, of having lost all of her people and her family. And then, if after that time of grieving she is not attractive anymore to the captor, he can't just discard her. She needs to be cared for financially. She needs to be treated with respect. So this is, I think, one of the many situations in the Pentateuch where we see God accommodating some of the existing practices of the people. Not necessarily, I don't think he's prescribing it's a good idea to marry captive women after a conquest. He's simply saying, this is what everyone does. I'm going to put some guardrails on this process so that it is not abused. And those guardrails, by and large, they're not there for protecting the captor. They're for protecting the captive party. So there's five verses for us, and that brings us up to verse 15, the right of the firstborn. And we have a reading for these next two or three sections. Reading C, please.
If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons, if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then it shall be in the day he wills what he has to his sons. He cannot make the son of the loved the firstborn before the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to them, then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him to the elders of his city at the gateway of his hometown. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst. And all Israel shall hear of it and fear. And if a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. You shall not see your countryman's ox or his sheep straying away and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countrymen. And if your countryman is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall remain with you until your countryman looks for it. Then you shall restore it to him. And thus you shall do with his donkey, and you shall do the same with his garment, and you shall do likewise with anything lost by your countrymen, which he has lost and you have found. You are not allowed to neglect them. You shall not see your countryman's donkey or his ox falling down the way and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly help him to raise them up.
Thank you. We can get a sense of the gear shifts in the text coming here, and they're getting faster. When we're talking about the right of the firstborn, does that ring a bell for anyone? Two wives, one loved and the other not, and the firstborn is from the unloved wife. We're getting a vignette of the life of Jacob. The favoritism that he showed in his household to Joseph is now very clearly shown as inappropriate. The right of the firstborn belonged to his firstborn, not to Joseph, despite of how he despised Leah. And so laws are written down as protection. So now we had a vignette showing Abraham obedient. Now we have a vignette showing Jacob as disobedient. And that those sort of views will continue. A rebellious son, verses 18 through 21. Some will point this out as a recipe for disciplining children, and I think that's a really curious use of the text. I've not heard, thankfully, in my time at CPC, of anyone proposing that we put their children to death, although there has been plenty of disobedience in that time from my household alone, let alone from others. This is what feels like a very severe law. It does picture an adult son. Notice what they're to say. Our son is a glutton and a drunkard. That doesn't typically happen at age 8. This is pictured someone adult. They're expected to be acting like an adult, and they're not. Why is the rebellious son to be put to death? Why such a harsh punishment that perhaps in our lifetime several of us would have been put to death for? We're known as a nation for having our rebellious 20s. Wild college years. Why such severity? Well, the text tells us, you shall purge the evil from among you. What is that verse? Is it 20?
21.
21, all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. You shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. What is paramount to God? It's not human life. Not that human life is not holy or valuable to the Lord. It's not paramount. It's not the top priority. The top priority for the Lord is the faithfulness of his people to them. And if someone is to be put to death so that the people will not be tempted to stray the way that that rebellious son did, then that is, in the Lord's estimation, a good thing. It is justice, in a word. It's not the sort of justice that we attempt to carry out in our nation today. It's a very different set of priorities than we might expect from the Lord. By the way, I don't mean to be taking a pot shot at the sanctity of human life with that statement. I'm not saying that it's invalid, only that it is not paramount in the Lord's economy. Yes?
But kind of bottom line, too. Being a glutton and a drunkard is not loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. I mean,
exactly. Disobeying, being extremely disobedient to the parents. Yeah. Joe?
I'm not trying to be cavalier here, but the wages of sin are death. We're all under a death sentence.
Yeah,
this
right.
is really more about the timing and
yeah.
the appropriateness of what's happening in the community. But yeah, I mean, whenever the death sentence is imposed, it is a very serious, sober thing, but we are all under that death sentence.
That's right, Joe. Mark, you had something to add there?
Well, not a whole lot of people, if they enforce this law, there wouldn't have been a whole lot of the various people in the 20s. Once you see your neighbor's kid being stoned to death, thinking, maybe I shouldn't drink so much.
Inverse peer pressure, yeah.
Yeah.
Amy?
I was going to say something similar. Is it seems to be a they're leading others astray. It's not just what they are doing, but others might follow them and might be peer pressure of, oh, we need to act like God's holy people.
Yeah. So we're reaping the whirlwind. We're 9 laws into this 40 law section. I'll give you a reminder. All of these, remember, just like this one, all of these tie back to God's people are to love, to fear him by loving him with all of their heart. This is how they were to work that out in the land. There was variety and depth, but let's not lose connection back to chapter 6, verse 1 as we go. And I give that warning because the cadence is about to accelerate. If it feels like we've been shifting gears quickly so far, get ready. 2 verses on hanging on a tree. Why do we not leave a cursed man hanging overnight? Because it's foul, because we're presenting death on the image of God, and that contrast is too much. Not specifically in the text, no. You shall not defile the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shouldn't leave him hanging overnight because this land is God's. And so these foul reminders of death are not to be out there for long. Shifting gears again. Yeah.
But this connects to Christ's death by being crucified, because that's the punishment. Cursed is he who hangs on a tree, so he's taking, that's when he's taking the curse upon himself.
That's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. That is why the New Testament points us back to this passage. It is an interesting use in that when we read cursed is everyone who's hanged upon a tree, we would think like that's a special curse. Not so much, this is the curse. And yet the New Testament interprets it in a slightly different way, saying well, Jesus has taken the curse of sin upon himself by being hanged upon a tree. So sort of an interesting use of the text there. I can't dig into it too much. Shifting gears again, verses 1 through 4 of chapter 22, we have obligations to care for our neighbor's property. This is the opposite of finders keepers. And I think that Jesus is referring back to this in Luke 14:5 when he asks them in a Sabbath conversation, which of you having an ox or a donkey in a pit on the Sabbath will not go and get it out? There is work that can be done on a Sabbath. If you see your neighbor's ox or your neighbor's donkey on the Sabbath wandering, what are you to do? You have a law that says do no work. You have a law that says you're responsible to restore it. What's it going to be? Jesus uses this conflict to illustrate for us that the Sabbath is for man and not man for the Sabbath. In a way, he's demonstrating work that reasonably is done on the Sabbath in what you might consider emergency or extraordinary circumstances. And he's really putting the Pharisees to the test with it and saying, you've picked out one part of the law and zeroed in on it, and you've neglected the rest. And in doing so, in zooming in on one statute and rule and forgetting other statutes and rules, you lose overall, of course, that one great commandment. That's why he says, if you knew Moses, you would know me, but you do not. Shifting gears again, one verse on gender distinction and clothing that's to be worn. Shifting gears again, verse 6, birds' nests and how birds are to be hunted. Seems creation care is not completely out of scope, even though we've moved so far from that garden narrative. Israel was not to plunder to the point of eliminating. This is almost like a, what do we call it, like conservation sort of perspective, that the birds are to be preserved. Verse 8, parapets and railing. We go from birds' nests to the roof of your house needing to have a railing around it. If you build something, you have a responsibility to those people who are going to be in the building, to make that building safe. We can think of this as very much an ancient ancestor of our modern liability code. If you have a house built and you build it in an unsafe way and someone comes to your house and is injured, you are liable for that. You're responsible for that injury. And that's very much in perspective here. But we get just one verse on it. Verse 9, prohibition of mixing natural distinctions. We saw that in Leviticus before, and we're hearing it repeated again here. We're not given much explanation in the text for precisely why these things are not to be mixed together. It seems to be perhaps a symbol of sin. Jesus talking about a little manna leavening the whole lump, that we are not to tolerate any mixture of holiness and sin together as a people, but I'll admit that that's a bit of a long-shot interpretation. The text simply doesn't tell us, and Moses, before giving an explanation, is telling us to move along. In verse 12, verse on tassels. The tassels seem to be a little bit easier to understand. They are there to remind us. Sorry, that's not in scope in this passage. That's in scope when they're prescribed in Leviticus. They're there to be a reminder to us, sort of like the writing on the back of our hand or frontlets between our eyes. But Moses doesn't have time to explain. He's not going to stop. Now he's moving on. Verse 13, we get to a larger section. We slow down a little bit as we talk about marriage, adultery, and rape. Why is adultery to be punished by death? Verse 21, verse 22, verse 24 tells us over and over again, it is to purge the evil from our midst. It's because the Lord wants the devotion of his people. He wants the holiness of his people. He wants them to love him with all of their heart. There are also humanitarian reasons for laws against those, but once again, those are not in focus. The Lord's priority is the holiness of his people, their love for him. Now we're going to start shifting gears even faster, if it hasn't been fast enough yet. 23, we've gotten up to verse 9 now, I think, with the marriage passage ends at verses 1 through 8. I've not even covered in my outline, it looks like. I've skipped those entirely. Covers the types of people who are not to be admitted to the assembly. A little bit unclear what it means to be admitted to the assembly, we don't have time to dig in much there. Changing gear, and Moses didn't spend a ton of time on it. Changing gears again, uncleanness in the camp, verses 9 through 14. Prescribes when they're gathered in a battle camp. You might think that this is an opportunity. You're in the military. You're with a bunch of guys. All the accountability of your home life is gone. You're somewhat anonymous. You could get away with some pretty rank behavior and conduct in this sort of situation. And I think the same is largely true of our military today, not necessarily known as being a time of high moral standards for the men who join. And yet there are several protections and guardrails set up here. And one of them we have to read through, not for the laugh factor, but to understand how extensive this law is meant to be. Verse 12, you shall have a place outside the camp and you shall go out to it. Seems a little strange. It's a bit of a euphemism. And you shall have a trowel with your tools. And when you sit down outside, you shall dig a hole with it and turn back and cover up your excrement. We have a law about how to use the toilet and where to use the toilet. Why so much extent? Why are we talking about poop in the Torah? There's this disconnect. Well, the next verse tells us precisely why. Because the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy so that he may not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. Why is it that we are to have a place outside the camp for using the restroom and it is to be buried when we're done? Well, because someone might step in it. Because for health reasons, it would be very bad for the camp to have you using the toilet in the middle of the camp. No, none of that. The reason is this land is the Lord's. And if you're going into battle, you want him to be among you. Totally different reason and rationale than we would prescribe for these things. Hopefully you're getting an idea from this variety what the priorities of the Lord are and how those priorities relate back to the one great commandment of loving the Lord our God with all of our heart and all of our soul and all of our mind. All right, so almost every attempt at organizing the Pentateuch breaks down here at these next verses. Most Bibles, if you have pericope headers, those little titles over paragraphs that are added for you to find things, call this miscellaneous laws. If they've been able to keep up with any sort of category or organization or description before, it's over now. This is 21 laws, verse 15 all the way up through chapter 25, verse 19 is the extent of the section. 21, of course, being a regular number for us to see in the Pentateuch. It's 3 times 7. We've seen lots of groupings of 21 laws in the book of Leviticus. And so here we have another. All right, and we're going to cover all of that in 10 minutes plus another chapter. Ready? Fugitive slaves are not to be turned over to their masters. Very interesting, something that perhaps our nation could have paid attention to and done well to adopt as our own law. Cult prostitution is forbidden. Maybe we're thinking back to Genesis 38, Judah thinking that his daughter-in-law was a cult prostitute as he went to worship idols. Interest collection on loans is forbidden within Israel. Why? Verse 20, that the Lord may bless you in all that you undertake in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. The true possession, the right to charge interest, isn't yours, it's God's. And so you're not to charge interest to your brothers. Verse 21, vows are to be kept promptly and taken circumspectly. Verse 24, farmers were to share their crops. And yet those who were partaking of that sharing, this is not a commercial sharing. You're not to go into the wheat field with a sickle, like, oh, the farmer's sharing. Thank goodness, let me take this to market. Instead, you're to pick with your hands what you want to eat. That's the sort of sharing that is had in mind. So protection on both sides there. Next chapter, verse 1, divorcees are not to remarry after remarrying someone else. Why? Verse 4, do not bring sin upon the land that the Lord is giving you. This is probably the chief example that people will refer back to of restraining evil, not eliminating evil. More proof that were you to keep every one of these statutes and rules, it doesn't mean that you're righteous, that you're blameless before the Lord. He's giving laws as guardrails to constrain his people, and the righteousness that they're to have has to come from somewhere else. We could spend a whole lesson there in verse 4, but we have to move forward, and I have to figure out where in my notes I left off. Verse 5, newlyweds are excluded from military service. Verse 6, millstones are not to be taken as a pledge. It's a little bit confusing today. I doubt you have, well, I think John might have. Other than John, you probably don't have a millstone in your house. The millstone was the way that you fed your family. We might say you're not to take a refrigerator in pledge today because the family has to eat. You're not to take as a pledge for a loan something that is so important that there's no possibility of that family moving forward or continuing to live. I think that it would be wonderful if our debt laws were perhaps updated a little bit to reflect this. If you are taking so much in interest and debt from someone that there's no possibility of them feeding their family, you will never get that debt paid, just very practically speaking, let alone in terms of ethics and morals and honoring the poor. Moving on, verse 7, kidnapping is forbidden. Why? Purge the evil from among your midst. This might be recalling Joseph as his brothers sold him into slavery. Once again, every reference back to everyone but Abraham, what are we referring to? The ways that they broke the law before it was given. With Abraham, we hear how he kept the law before it was given. Verse 8 covers leprosy and really doesn't tell us what to do about leprosy. It says, do whatever the priests tell you. This is almost like see Leviticus, just going to have a cross-reference here. You guys can refer back to it on your own. Moses is going to move on. Verse 10, debts are not to be forcibly collected, and the poor man's pledge is to be returned to him before the day is over. Once again, mercy for the poor who are in debt, and guardrails around how debt was going to work within Israel. Verse 14, pay the poor their wages promptly. Even, perhaps especially, it's highlighting sojourners, migrant workers, those who don't live in the land, who are there temporarily. We may be tempted to cheat them because they're easy to cheat. And yet we should make sure to pay that debt more promptly than if you were paying a rich man who you know you can't escape. Let's see, verse 16, punishment is not applied to family members, just to the individual who sinned. Verse 17, justice should not disenfranchise the poor. We don't favor the rich in court. Verse 19, gleanings are to be left in the poor. If you miss something in your first pass on the field, leave it there for the poor to come and eat. Next chapter, verse 1, beatings are to be decreed by judges, not just by anybody, and they're to be carried out in the presence of judges. This is not crowd justice. This is not even the avenger sort of rule, or what is it called, the avenger of blood. Rather, this limits the punishment to 40 lashes. And of course, this comes to be very relevant in the New Testament as well. Let's see, we've already covered that. Verse 4, do not muzzle an ox while it treads a grain. Verse 5, and we just move on. Why? What does this mean? How are we to apply it? No idea. Paul will reach back and give us some explanation as to why we are to pay those of your elders who teach especially well, what we call pastors today. You are to pay them because you're not to muzzle an ox while treading the grain. Certainly not a literal application of that particular law, but it seems Paul was looking back to these statutes and rules for principles that he wanted to apply but that we should apply even today in the church, though this particular statute and rule may not directly apply as something that we need to do. Verse 5, leveret marriage. This is the only description of leveret marriage. That's the marrying of a widow to her brother-in-law in the Torah. But remember, it played a huge role in Genesis chapter 38. That was the unrighteousness of Judah to not give his sons in leveret marriage, or their refusal, his son's refusal, not to perform the act of a brother-in-law. And here we get 6 verses of how despicable it is for a brother not to provide for his deceased brother. He is to be humiliated, and his house is to be known as the house of him who had his sandal removed. Doesn't quite translate into English with the force that it seems to have had in Hebrew, but one way or the other, the emphasis there is that his whole household is to be humiliated over his act. Verse 11, this covers a woman grabbing a man's genitals during a quarrel. Really weird law, I'm going to be honest. Maybe this just emphasizes the variety, the uniqueness. It's hard to say when this would have happened or why. Mark, did you have something to add there?
I object to calling it God's law is weird, but I mean, it says when it would happen. I mean, apparently it was something that would happen. So they had a law against it. In verse 12, her hand is not cut off. It says her hand is split, as if make a deep cut in her hand, so it's not as might sound. So her hand has some kind of deep cut into it, but her hand is not cut off.
That's interesting. I know the ESV says you shall cut off her hand, but I don't know really the reason for that translation or the linguistic decisions that are being made there. It's interesting. It is, if it does mean cut off, it is the only place in the Torah where cutting off of a limb is prescribed for any crime. So it is unusual in that sense.
It would be very unusual.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know why they translated that way.
Well, I think despite how late it is, we are going to make it here. Verse 13, dual scales are prohibited. This seems pretty obvious. You don't have a dishonest way of measuring, one way to measure for things that are incoming, another way to measure for things that are outgoing. They need to be the same. Why is it? Because you shouldn't steal. No, verse 15, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord is giving you. And the last of our 21, we're getting there. Verse 17, remember what Amalek did. Verse 19 particularly, when the Lord has given you rest in the land that the Lord is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you are to blot out Amalek. So once again, a focus on the land being the Lord's. That is the why of these laws. All right, the worst part of the whirlwind is over. We have two sections left to cover in chapter 26. Would someone read verses 1 through 15 for us, please? Thank you. So Moses sort of brings us full circle. He shifts our attention back towards not only the first seven chapters of the whirlwind, so to speak, as we've turned our attention back to worship, but he gives us a particular process, a particular thing to be recited as Israel comes into the land for their first fruits and their tithes. And he gives them something that it seems is to be memorized. Carrying us all the way back to chapter 6, the words of this covenant shall be on your heart. You have something to memorize as you come to bring these things and as you begin your feast in the land. And we get I'm going to read myself our conclusion. This wraps up Moses' sermon for sure. We've said these chapters, we're not sure, these 15, they're part of the sermon or just sort of tacked on. One way or the other, chapter 27 brings a new section. And I hope that I know I will be thankful. Chapter 27 allows us to slow down. Next week, we expect to cover three chapters. Your homework is to read four, chapters 27 through 30. And for the rest of the class, we'll be able to really pay more attention as I think Moses himself slows down. And in chapter 29, the gears shift in a really unexpected and somewhat unexpected and surprising way for us. So that's where we're headed, but I'll close with these words. This day the Lord your God commands you to do these statutes and rules, reading from verse 16, by the way. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with all your soul. You have declared today that the Lord is your God and that you will walk in all his ways and keep his statutes and his commandments and his rules and will obey his voice. And the Lord has declared today that you are a people for his treasured possession, as he has promised you, and that you are to keep all his commandments, and that he will set you in praise and in fame and in honor, high above all nations that he has made, and that you shall be a people holy to the Lord, to the Lord your God, as he has promised. Father, we thank you for these words. We thank you for the great promises, and we ask that you would set your spirit at work in our hearts, that we might love you wholeheartedly, that we might look at every extent of our lives and reflect on how we are loving you wholeheartedly, if we are obeying the spirit of this law, even if the letter may not be particularly for your people today. Help us to not miss, as we continue to go, Moses' point in explaining the law to us, so that we might, through Moses, know in a way that Israel didn't, we might know Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen.